Hello, everybody. It's John Pollock joining me as always, waiting for our WWE Crown Jewel review. Moments after night one in Riyadh. How are you, Wei?
I'm doing well. Yeah, night one of two.
Night one of two. This is the first time they're going to do Raw. This followed earlier this year where they did the SmackDown King and Queen of the Ring combo. So we will be getting into things. How is your Saturday going on this this now afternoon as we bridge into the evening?
Pretty well. Yeah, I quite like these afternoon shows. You know, we've spoken about that pretty much every time we've had one of these, either in Europe or I guess Saudi, you know, like I quite enjoyed the time zone change for me.
Did you catch the start time for Survivor Series?
I did not. What time is it?
It is a 6 p.m. Eastern start time that they were. This has been listed on the website, but it was noted on the ad that they were promoting tonight. So
is there a UFC that night?
Not a pay-per-view.
Okay.
I believe a fight night. So I don't think it's for that reason, but nonetheless, I mean,
does this seem like it'll be, is it a West Coast thing?
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, it's, I don't know. I could try and ask and find out what the reasoning is for this. I believe it's just a one-off because I believe the Royal Rumble is advertised back at 7 p.m., which seemed to be the new start time that pretty much all the North American events have been following, save for this Survivor Series, which one would think Survivor Series might just end up being a longer show that mm-hmm. we might still have the usual start time for us. But mm-hmm. that's 4 weeks from now. We're going to get into Crown Jewel. I do want to make a note off the top that over the last week or so, we did have a Karim Zidane on Pollock and Thurston, and we did section that off. It is up on the Post Wrestling YouTube channel. You can check out that as well as last week's edition of Pollock and Thurston talking about really just the continued involvement of Saudi Arabia beyond professional wrestling, but also as it has extended significantly its investment into boxing, into mixed martial arts, and pro wrestling being one of the centerpieces of its combat sports strategies, which for the sake of this argument, we'll consider pro wrestling under that combat sports umbrella.
Oh, absolutely. I would. Yeah. These conversations kind of come around every single time that there's one of these shows. And I kind of feel like, the conversations are getting less and less loud, but, it's still really, it's the reason why we are talking about the show today. So, there are some great resources. Karim is always a great voice in speaking about all of this stuff. So it's out there if you guys want to listen to it. And yeah, check that out.
Yeah, and we will get into the pre-show and main show where a lot of this stuff does pop up. But we're going to rewind to Friday where several WWE cuts were announced. We had Indy Hartwell and Tegan Nox, who have been released from their deals, and then Baron Corbin, whose contract is set to expire and they're not renewing it. So three names here. Interestingly enough, we were just talking about Indy Hartwell the other day, that of all this time, she got the call up when she was hurt. And that seemed to be where she was finally gaining a bit of a buzz for herself at the NXT level. Like, she did have the Dexter Lumis story, but then winning the NXT women's title, she gets hurt and they do the call up. And I think that really fumbled her ascent onto the main roster and has largely been one of those women that's just been forgotten for months, ironically, just given a story attached with Candice LeRae and Nia Jax, and even because SmackDown was taped last week, wrestled on Friday's SmackDown hours after this announcement of her release. Tegan Nox is someone that, I mean, you can't be too surprised by. It feels as though they had no plans for this woman. She had last wrestled on Raw back in April and had not even had a match period since July the 5th. And then you have Baron Corbin, who, interestingly enough, was, I think, had maybe his best run was in NXT alongside Bron Breakker, and then was brought up. And I mean, him and Apollo Crews, like, it never clicked for the few times that we got to see them, and had basically been removed from television and just feels like they were out of ideas for him too. But I'm curious, any of you, and it's worth noting, Corbin, since his deal is just coming due, once that deal expires, he'll be free to go anywhere. For Hartwell and Knox, these are releases, so they have 90-day non-competes before they can compete. But you're also talking about people that are international talent too, so they're going to have the visa situation to handle as well, being in a non-WWE work environment.
Yeah, those two particular situations, I mean, I feel like we should probably talk about that first and foremost, because it's potentially threatening to just their ways of life and the ways that, you know, the two of them are able to make a living. So hopefully they're able to sort that out. And hopefully, you know, they if it's their choice to stick around in North America to continue their careers or do whatever else, I hope they find that. You know, in terms of these types of stories, we don't hear about them all that often these days. But with the amount of people that they continue to bring up into these systems via NIL or this WWE ID, I mean, something has to give, you know. I don't think any business should just, as profitable as this company is, I don't think any business should just be there to, like, be charity, you know, and just, like, hoard people for the sake of hoarding them, for the sake of their own career developments. If they weren't being used, if they weren't being given opportunities to perform, then I think cuts are need to occur. In the case of Indy Hartwell, I feel bad for, like, you know, kind of harshly criticizing her, some of her latest performances, but she hasn't really been improving in the time that we've seen her, unfortunately. In ring, when the waters are getting deeper and deeper and deeper in terms of athleticism and just, like, ability and charisma, unfortunately, in the time that she was on TV, and you can argue she wasn't given the right opportunities, but in the times that she has been given an opportunity, I think you can argue that she hasn't really been developing in the way that others may have. Tegan Knox is a bit of a questionable one. I definitely think her, I would argue more, is somebody that we haven't seen her, you know, get the right opportunities with. The biggest thing attached to her career has been her injuries, and heartbreaking injuries at that, you know, that have derailed her. But at the same time, those injuries are kind of like the things that have made her appealing, you can argue, because people want to see this comeback story. And it's something that just kind of never really materialized on the main roster for whatever reason. So, some wasted potential maybe there. And with Baron Corbin, the person who I think has achieved the most, certainly among this group, but I think you could see a clear shift in maybe the Levesque era and how they might have seen him and his potential versus maybe how a Vince McMahon might have seen a Baron Corbin. You know, any thoughts on any of them yourself?
I think that Baron Corbin, as much as we talk about, you know, talent that have the most, I would say, like, residual fan resentment from the Vince McMahon last number of years. We look at Austin Theory as someone that kind of had to wear that after Vince left. I think a lot of people associate, like, those really awful years of creative where Baron Corbin was put front and center with the Constable Corbin and just constantly thrown onto all of these big positions. And I think in time, I think there was a turnaround for Baron Corbin of that sentiment among a lot of the audience, whether it was the what was it, Lucky Corbin, Happy Corbin, where he was broke, then he came into money.
All these adjectives.
He's had so many different ones. And, I mean, the question is going to be for him is, you know, he's 40 years old. He has only been in this system, and that's 12 years. And that's it's a tough spot at 40 to suddenly go to, like, let's throw out an AEW. And if not an AEW, like, at the independent level, like, I am sure this guy could have a great run in a Game Changer or an Impact. Is he going to want to do that? I guess that's the question that he is left with. I'm sure he has had some very, like, this guy's been on the main roster for 8 years, almost, mm-hmm. almost nine. He's had some significant years and only been in the system. So that's the question attached to him. And will Thomas Peacestock be as marketable a name as without Baron Corbin?
That is the bigger question. What name does he go by outside of the WWE system? I wonder.
Yeah.
Yeah, with him, I mean, I would have to assume part of the reason why he might be included in this round of cuts is I'm assuming at that level of tenure, he was probably making a pretty good paycheck, you know, within the WWE system. And I don't know if there are any other companies out there if that would be able to match it. I certainly don't see him as a name that AEW might be able to make use of. But, you know, maybe there's some creative suggestion out there that is perfect for a Baron Corbin AEW. And outside of that, I think at this point, like this sort of like Matt Cardona GCW run, Matt Cardona / JBL, you know, like ironic GCW run or indie wrestling run, there's plenty of appeal for it. But even that almost feels like it's a little cliche these days. But that's it.
Let's also give some credit to Matt Cardona that there have been many of these performers that we have made that suggestion of that they could emulate, and how many have? Like Matt Cardona created a lane for himself. He has done very well for himself, but like I just throw out a name, and Nick Nemeth, I would not call him. He has not been a bust since leaving WWE, but he's not that name that is just sweeping the independents and has become this massive star outside of WWE. That's even like in the independent world, like he's doing fine in Impact. He's a very good performer, but I think it also does shine a light on like Matt Cardona was like timing helped, but this guy also had like a pretty good sense of what was going to work at this level and really attacking it, because you do have to attack the independents, and it's a very big transition when you're only brought up in a WWE system where so many of these aspects of the business are taken care of for you, and like you are your own boss and kind of carving your own plan. Like you are your creative, you are all of those things. The wins and the losses all come down on your plate.
And even that scene is you can argue pretty crowded now, you know, like not just forget AEW being too crowded. Even the indies might be a little too crowded for your ex WWE names. So that, you know, who really is your difference maker? Corbin has never really made a name for himself as this great in-ring worker that you could see getting that sort of demand for indie promotions that might put more of an emphasis on it. But again, like people, can
this guy
creative.
Might have a lucha run in him, Baron Corbin. Maybe CMLL, AAA. Maybe
does he join JBL?
Yeah. Maybe he's JBL's foreign investment partner. Perhaps.
Listen, there are creative opportunities out there for somebody like him. So we'll see if he takes advantage or if he just instead chooses to do something else.
That's it. That's JBL's monetary advisor, Bit Corbin.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. Also tonight, on the SEC network, Bill Goldberg was on, and he was asked about his recent appearance at Bad Blood and what is going to be next for Bill Goldberg.
We saw you, Bill, go back and forth at a WWE event last month in Atlanta. Any chance of a last match?
I just wanted to be there with my family and relax and have a good time. But you know what? Here's the deal. And here's the news of the day. The news of the day is, per three executives, Nick Khan, Chris Legentil, and Paul Levesque, in 2025, Goldberg's having his retirement.
Let's go! Let's go!
So, I think we know who the subject or the victim, probably the front runner right now. We know who it is.
Victim,
100%. Yeah. But, you know, 2025, Goldberg makes his return, retirement
still
match.
Can't
yeah,
wait. Bro.
Yeah, I got a couple months to get ready, you know. No All date, right. No time. So we'll see.
Stay tuned.
So there you have Bill Goldberg citing three sources. Very, very strong reporting from Bill Goldberg. Bill Goldberg's retirement presented by Nick Khan, Chris Legentil, and Paul Levesque, as he mentioned there. So yeah, you cannot obviously see the visual there, but they had highlights of him getting involved with Gunther, who I guess is alluded to as that retirement opponent. And you can add him to the list of retirees in 2025/26 is going to be the years of the retirement, with the farewell to Cena, the farewell to Tanahashi, and we'll squeeze Mako Satomura, and then Goldberg is going to do a farewell match on top of it.
Yeah, now, does this mean that it'll only just be that one Gunther match that'll be on his agenda for the year?
Not necessarily. I mean, I don't know if you would want to just throw him into one match if you could get more than one out of him, but certainly seems like it is building towards that. And they are eyeing 2025, so that would seem that anything like a Saturday night's main event would probably be, well, again, it does sound as though they're building up to one big match, but you know, the one thing with Goldberg is that when he does these matches, like, he really does go all in on the training, and it's like, he is vocalized, like, it's a lot on him to get prepared for these matches, and it's a lot harder to play Bill Goldberg at 60 than it was at 35.
Certainly, yeah. But, you know, like, given, I think, the character, given, I think, what we've seen of him even recently, I think he could pull it off. I mean, really, he just needs a good 5-minute sprint, doesn't he? And that's kind of all we are looking for out of a Bill Goldberg retirement match. We want to just see him, like, do the big entrance from the back, come out full of intensity, maybe a bit of blood on his forehead after knocking himself out on the locker backstage, spear, jackhammer, like, growls. That's kind of all I want to see, you know? So, I hope he could pull that off.
Yeah. Let's not age him too much. He turns 58 in December. So not
quite. So what are you saying? He's just getting started?
Could be. I mean, maybe he could have seen 60 if he wanted to push it, but yeah, that was added there. So, I mean, the other factor is just like a lot of these irons in the fire that WWE has for its 2025. And I don't think a Goldberg retirement match is insignificant either, especially if you're looking like, I don't even know if a WrestleMania necessarily needs that, but one of these other shows, like, that becomes a big focus. Especially if you could do it in somewhere like in Atlanta or somewhere of significance.
I could see it being a Saudi show.
It could very well.
He's kind of had much of his Saudi career, like, post whatever you want to call these few years in Saudi Arabia. So
yeah. And I mean, the timing of announcing this today as well, that they had, I mean, mm-hmm. that could very well be something that they do next year. All right. Those are the news and notes that we're going to go through, because we do have the event to get through from Riyadh at Mohammed Abdu Arena that they constantly referred to as a sellout, although not giving any numbers. The pre-show, and I did
so, go... So the building is advertised to hold, what, 20,000, 22,000, something like that?
Yeah, but they never gave any number. No. They just constantly referred to it as a sellout. The pre-show was very interesting. There were several interesting notes on this. We had Michael Cole, Corey Graves, and Big E on the panel, and there were interviews throughout the show with Seth Rollins, with LA Knight, and there was one with Kevin Owens, where he's interviewed by Kathy Kelly, and he mentions that earlier in the week, during a promotional appearance, they went out on dune buggies into the desert, and Kelly was in the same dune buggy as Kevin Owens, and they ended up flipping 3 times. And Owens explained, like, we were in a car accident, and he wove this into storyline that it must have been Orton and Cody putting the driver up to this to try and take him out. And like, I did check in on this. Like, this is a legit deal. And
Kathy Kelly posted footage of it.
Did she post footage of it? Interesting.
Or at least of the flip buggy, not of them actually flipping. But,
yeah. I mean, this was this sounded nuts and could have only happened a few days ago. And it's not as though Owens did an insignificant amount of physicality on this show. They appeared to be okay based on just visually here. But that's a scary deal. You know, when, like, this sounded like a really bad deal.
Yeah, I'm not going to get on one of those things anytime soon. But, yeah, I'm surprised that they would let their athletes take that level of risk.
So on the pre-show, I would state of the last number of years of Saudi shows, I thought, like, the messaging and promotion was very amplified on this pre-show than normal. There's a big focus on the WWE experience, which is their, like, physical kind of exhibit that they have permanently stationed there in Saudi Arabia. And then Natalie Mamo, who is a host in the Middle East and hosts the WWE show over there. She also does NBA work. She did a sit down with Paul Levesque and was asked about this partnership. He loves this partnership, and that over the years, fans initially, when this deal was announced, they were excited, but they didn't know what to expect. That's one way of characterizing it. But over years, we have seen the addition of women's matches. Now, His Excellency, as he was referred to many times, never identified by name, Turki Al-Sheikh, and the General Entertainment Authority, now they are contacting WWE. They want more women represented on the show. And also adding that the Crown Jewel Championships that have been transported from city to city in the U.S., they will permanently be stationed in Saudi Arabia, while the winners will receive rings. Rings to wear.
Rings to wear. And Levesque sort of said, with the additional note, that so they can go for multiple rings.
Yes.
That's sort of the gimmick, yeah.
Okay, so it starts with one.
We kind of all know what this like Crown Jewel Championship is. It's a stunt for once a year for these sort of specific shows. And you can argue that like prior attempts at making this sort of thing, whether it be with the Greatest Royal Rumble or like the Best in the World Trophy, have sort of been like never referenced and non-canonical outside of these particular events. This kind of allows them to maintain that status with these championships. We'll see how much they reference it, but like they're certainly not going to be carrying these giant monstrosities of belts, but they can hold on to these rings, which are much more manageable to carry around. But we'll even see how often they pull out these rings.
Yeah, and then as they left this interview, we go back to the panel, and this is when Michael Cole talks about 5 years ago, we had the first women's match here, and now we have 10 women on this year's show, and Corey Graves talked about how the tourism is great here, the food is tremendous here, and that was our recommendation by Corey Graves.
Yeah. I mean, over the years, maybe coming off of the Khashoggi murder, we've had just a slow ramping up of these sort of things. Ultimately, I don't think that at this point they're shy at all about like making these tourism ads like pretty blatant and deliberate. And I don't necessarily think that they have to be ashamed of that. Now, the first show that we've had one of these where, like, they were talking about how progressive, the society is, and, like, with frequent mentions of MBS, talking about how, women now have a right to drive. I don't think we're in that territory quite yet. Like, this was mostly promoting, hey, like, Riyadh is great. Look at this Boulevard City thing, and look at our WWE experience. This is a great place to, have a vacation. That's about as much as they're going, but I can see that changing. The world is getting more and more comfortable with these partnerships. If we look at maybe other sports, this might, what you saw in the WWE show tonight might even be tame in comparison these days.
I found that, like, I agree with your points in terms of like that there is certainly none of the hesitation of the past, but I did find it interesting that, as we noted when we reviewed Bad Blood, and what do you remember when Paul Levesque started promoting Crown Jewel in the ring? There's like this audible booing from the audience. And when I was writing up my piece on Friday, I went back to the YouTube version, and the YouTube version, like it has Hunter's walk out, and then we cut to post boos where he just speaks, and they cut that part out, and you can kind of understand that. So then I was curious, and I went to the WWE Network version, which is not going to have a cut in the middle, and it is very clear that they remove the boos, and you get like subtle, like you get cheers in place of that. I was like, that is absolutely not how. So I mean, they are
right.
They are very much projecting the image that they do not want to have these reactions of fans booing these shows to be present. And like the image, like this is image laundering that, is part of this $50 million. And I do feel it is important to talk about this, because this is like the shows are not happening if not for $50 million. So let's just be clear about that. Like, this is a transaction.
Well, we have to be clear about just the simple fact that this is just commerce. Saudi Arabia, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, are a sponsor of the show in the way that, I don't know, like Snickers might be, in the way that like whatever cereal companies might be. And it's the WWE's job to promote and make their sponsors look good. And something like that, I think, is understandable. That they would make those sort of edits, and yeah, it makes me wonder if how free they'll feel to maybe make those sort of public announcements about Saudi Arabia in the future, if they have that sort of like combative relationship with the crowd to deal with.
Yes. No, did you know graphics afterwards about, this year being the bloodiest for Saudi death row prisoners of the past 30 years.
Maybe you'll find that in the WWE Experience. Maybe that'll be a booth.
Maybe. It's right next to the Undertaker Dead Man Experience.
Oh, man.
So there you go. That was the pre-show. On to the main show we go. Michael Cole and Corey Graves are our announcers who will be sticking around for Raw on Monday. And opening the show is Solo Sikoa, Jacob Fatu, and Tama Tonga taking on Roman Reigns and the Usos. So the way this is, it's 3-on-3, though Tonga Loa was in the corner of the Bloodline.
Mm-hmm.
Reigns and Jimmy enter together. A thunderous reaction follows for Jay's entrance through the crowd. You have to look at the audience on this show. Like the early days of these Saudi cards in the beginning of this deal, like the atmosphere was awful for some of these shows. And that is the complete opposite. Like this crowd was just so energetic and lively for 3.5 hours. And it was like this was like a big time atmosphere that they had for this show, and it kicked off with this Jey Uso entrance that was pretty spectacular.
I thought one of the best crowds of the entire year, you know. And I don't know like what sort of necessitated that, or at least like what created that sort of change compared to maybe some of these earlier shows. Are they letting in different types of people into these events than they were in the very first shows? I don't know, but I could definitely say, like, you know, there's been a bit of an evolution in these Saudi crowds where now they're at the point now where they're clearly diehard fans that are in there. These are the people that know the words to every single word to like a Randy Orton song or to a Cody Rhodes song. And they reacted massively, and I think helped positively color a lot of the presentations of these matches. I think it's notable that we saw Jey Uso come out last here. That's not typically how things went with the Bloodline. That never is how things went. So I think it plays to the story. It's good attention to detail for the story that Roman is allowing main event Jey Uso to enter last.
Yeah, it's kind of a compromise where Jay has said the three of us are now equals. Whereas Jimmy's like, I'm okay being, you know, Roman sidekick.
I'm not really at that level yet.
Yeah. So the crowd is vociferously chanting for Roman, and Jay teases tagging him, but instead tags Jimmy to prove who's in charge. And this leads to an argument among them as Tama Tonga capitalizes, and they had the heat on Jay. And then finally, Reigns is entering, and he is in with Solo Sikoa, and they start battling. And Reigns calls for the Superman punch, but it's caught by Sikoa. Second attempt hits the Superman punch, and as he sets up for the spear, Solo Sikoa kicks him in the face and hits the Samoan spike. And Sikoa gets on top of Reigns, and the referee is counting, and Jimmy is way late for the save. And like Ryan Tran just has to hold up his hand because Jimmy was nowhere ready to break this up. And what we had was almost a replication, at least in theory, of what we just saw with Christian Cage and Jay White, where the actual finish of the match was going to be done as a near fall earlier. Because this, and I'm sure that this was the confusion, was, okay, the Samoan spike is the finish, and it seemed like it was just too late for the save to be made, that Roman was to be saved here.
I mean, in this case, I don't know if it was so much confusion on Jimmy's part. I mean, I have to assume Jimmy knew that the bulk of the finish hadn't occurred yet. It just looked like he might have got a little bit tripped up in the ropes, but certainly looked a little bit late, I think we could say.
This looked a lot late.
Yeah,
and this was an extremely forgiving crowd because 90% of crowds would just so heavily boo this spot. Like we don't get "you fucked up" chants anymore, but we definitely get audible boos when it's a clear like mistiming on a kickout.
I would say like it did take the crowd down a notch though, coming off of this, because I think it at least dampened a lot of the maybe rising momentum, you know, heading like building up throughout this match. This was a big fuck up, unfortunately. And you always feel bad for the referee in these situations, you know, but you know, like the edict or whatever unofficially is that refs should count as if they were legitimate. What the fuck was this referee supposed to do in this situation? Okay. This is Roman Reigns. All right, in the main event, he would have gotten heat if not like okay. So if he didn't count it, I'm sure maybe he's getting
in this case.
Up.
It actually is like had he just counted it legit, it was actually what the finish was. So I mean, it's rare that happens.
But you'd be counting Roman eating one Samoan spike rather than Roman eating a totality of three Samoan spikes, which you know would have had him chewed out maybe from other people. Like maybe Roman would have been really mad at that. So this guy Ryan Tran really had nothing like a split second decision to make, and you can't really fault him for doing either one.
The referee is always in like the unenviable spot where he's either going to be the fall guy in any situation, no matter what you do. So then they try and get things back on track here. Jay and Fatu square off. There's super kicks sending Jacob out of the ring. And then Jay goes for a suicide dive. It's caught, and Fatu headbutts him. And that's about the last we see of Jay. And there's a Superman punch to Sokoa. Then he throws Tongaloa into the ring, landing on poor referee Ryan Train, who's just having a hell of a night. And Reigns gets struck by Fatu, hit by the springboard moonsault, and then there is a dive by Fatu onto both Usos on the floor, and Reigns, selling the effects of the moonsault, gets hit with two follow-up Samoan spikes, and Solo pins Roman at 16 minutes and 35 seconds. So it ends up being the finish that was teased several minutes earlier and giving a dominant win for the Bloodline. We'll get to the post-match after. I did not think this was a very... Like, it was an engaging match for the audience. It had a lot of star power. But in terms of a match, I mean, this did almost nothing for me. I just found it to be very slow, very much just reliant on a lot of just signature spots, teases of altercations. And I was not impressed with this match.
I feel like that sort of review is very reminiscent of many of these Bloodline story heavy types of matches, in particular like ones that revolve around Solo Sokoa, who I think to this point has still yet to really find a captivating in-ring style as a lead to maybe make these matches a lot more compelling. But that said, you know, I always tend to weigh more on the match's success based off of the crowd reactions. And, you know, while the match was nothing spectacular, I mean, they got some great reactions for every single character, every single interaction, I would say, in this match. When a crowd is really this into the story, I don't think you need to be all that fancy with some of the wrestling. I was surprised by the outcome here, because with Jimmy Uso in there, you would expect that he'd be the one to get the pinfall. But instead, they had Solo pin Roman Reigns. And I liked it a lot more, you know, like we know coming out of this match, the goal was probably to make Solo's Bloodline look strong heading into War Games. I expected them to pin Jimmy to achieve that, but they went a step further and had Solo pin Roman to achieve it, which I think does a lot more for the entire group than just them pinning Jimmy.
Yeah. So the last people over the past almost 5 years to beat Roman Reigns, we have Cody Rhodes, Jey Uso in that tag match last year, and Thomas Peacestalk.
Baron Corbin himself.
That's right, yes. I like the finish, too. I think Sokoa needed it the most here. And, I mean, this was the most obvious finish for the Bloodline to win this match, and they went with the most impactful one. Like, Roman Reigns being pinned is a significant deal. And afterward, the beatdown continues. They have the numbers advantage. It's 4-on-3. When Sami Zayn's music plays, and Sami Zayn comes out and he's wearing a keffiyeh, and this, you know, his obvious support of Palestinians. And a lot was made of this comment that Corey Graves made, like post save, about Sami Zayn always taking an opportunity to virtue signal. I mean, I missed it the first time, so I did go back to kind of hear context.
He said that?
Corey Graves said this, yes. It was after Zayn had made the save. And I listened to it. It's like, I feel like you could, if you want to believe that it was in reference to what Sami Zayn was wearing, like you can make that argument. I think you could also have the plausible deniability that he was trying to refer to the character and how he was virtue signaling here.
But Graves just does not at all seem like the type to like be that bold on commentary. Like to make
sometimes, I mean,
like
there's times he lets his feelings through. Listen, however you interpret it is how you did. But this was a big deal to people. Like I did see comments about it. That's why I went back to like hear it myself, because I missed it in the moment when the line was uttered. But there is a political statement here, of course. But Zayn is out and he comes in. And they do this long pause as he's eyeing Solo Sokoa. And they did this really well, where Solo extends the arms for a hug. Sammy then extends his arms. And as he goes to hug Sokoa, turns it into an exploder. I really like the way they like they tease this coming off the conversation in the car on Raw and attacks them, joins with, well, assists Reigns and the Usos, but then with Solo Sikoa surrounded by the four, they have him cornered, and Zayn and Reigns run at Solo for a dual Superman punch / Huluva kick. Sikoa gets out of the way. If I had a dime for every time my attacks have been thwarted by this same misdirection, and they clobber one another. This was as well timed as you could for if you were laying this out to someone, there's like, this could look so goofy, and maybe it did a little bit. But anyway, Zayn nails Reigns. So Reigns and Zayn are not on the same page here. Jimmy is upset with Zayn, and Zayn just storms off on his own and leaves. So you're not doing the united front of these four, but that is, you have 4 weeks to get there.
No, there's a lot more storytelling and a lot more TV time that they need to fill before we get there. The timing on that particular spot at the very end with the friendly fire, I would say they got about maybe 85% of the way there. You know, it's really, really difficult to time.
Very tough.
The replays, don't worry, we'll clean it up perfectly and you'll make it, you know, it'll be seamless. Something I really loved about all this. I mean, this is Roman Reigns now. Not only did he take the pinfall in this match, he also was the one laid out by Sami Zayn at the end of this. And they have this wonderful over-the-shoulder shot of Roman looking completely down in the dumps, reflecting, of course, the Cody Rhodes WrestleMania 39 moment where Roman was in the background. And Cody was, you know, this is the story of the hero at his lowest. And it wonderfully sets up, you know, I think Roman Reigns' eventual comeback and return to regaining the tribal chief role. So in terms of storytelling, I think they did a great job overall with all of this. They did a great job of like, you know, emphasizing Jey Uso's ascent to now feeling like somewhat of an equal to Roman Reigns. And they also showed Roman now kind of being at his lowest. So they have 4 weeks to go. I'm looking forward to all of that storytelling, because anytime this new bloodline the original bloodline are together, it's magic. It is. And of course we got Paul Heyman probably somewhere out there as well.
This in total took up like the first hour of the event. It was this was only like a 16 and a half minute match, but it was like 2 Eastern by the time this was all concluded.
It was only 16 minutes?
Yeah. Yeah. This was the second longest match on the show.
So we're talking about just like opening videos and
the intro to the show. The entrances on this show were so lengthy. I mean, they really add up to eat such a chunk out of this. Like, these were not, like, basically we had 6 matches on the show and a big angle with Orton and Owens. And this was nearly 3.5 hours. So this is when I texted UA and was like, this is going to be a really long show. And we might be going late. Bianca Belair and Jade Cargill against Lash Legend and Chikara Jackson, Piper Niven and Chelsea Green, and Io Sky and Kairi Sane for the women's tag titles. So some of the outfits here, Belair and Jade were in these sequined outfits. Jackson was auditioning for the role of Mystique. And then we had, you know, just we have come a long way from the overnight sleepover shirts.
Oh, my God. Like, you look back and you wonder, like, why? Oh man, what sort of direction and what sort of like rules they were up against that we had to live through that? When, listen, like, I don't exactly know how to comment on this, because on the one hand, like, it's, we know these are restrictions, but at the same time, I admire the creativity that like the seamstresses and the costume designers have put into making these outfits feel special, and like they're actually like maybe even a featured part of like these particular shows. They make these women look incredible, you know, and they're all distinct. I mean, to me, like, it's actually one of the things that I kind of look forward to.
So the match begins, and you know, they're clearly positioning Jade Cargill and Lash Legend as the big athletic powerhouses of the eight. And they got towards this on SmackDown and continued it here of teasing interaction between them. But in between, we had, Sane hoists Sky overhead, sending her into the corner. And this was our first slip on the top rope, as she just had to like reset. And it was interesting because it was like the identical spot later with LA Knight, where he slipped in the exact same place in that particular corner. Belair hit a blockbuster to Niven off the top, and then Lash ends up pump kicking Belair. Jade then enters with Lash, and they exchange blows, and Jade lands her pump kick. Then we had Chelsea Green. She climbs to the top, teasing a moonsault to the floor, but then she climbs down to the bottom turnbuckle, then to the apron, and she just can't do it and gets caught by Niven. And I thought this was a great spot for Chelsea Green, who should not be doing Orihara's to the floor for her character. Sane then climbs and hits the insane elbow onto Niven and Green, followed by a moonsault from Io to the floor. Jackson then comes off the shoulders of Lash with a high cross, and this crowd's going bonkers for this. Belair clotheslines Lash. Everyone is on the floor. And then Green backs up into the ring, into Jaded. Damage control makes the save. Now, for all the complaints I always see about the tag matches in AEW and the referees, there was no tags going on. This was just full-out tornado tag rules at this point in the match. And I'm not even complaining. It was better because of it. But let's not have a double standard here.
Chelsea was the legal person, though.
I think that she tagged Niven, who had just tagged out, and at one point the announcers were even confused on who the legal person was, and at this point they kind of just threw it out because all eight were just in there exchanging stuff. Lash then hoists Sane in the air to send her for a sit-out powerbomb by Jackson, but she comes up short, and Sane just comes down and like cradles her neck. Corey Graves goes nuts. That's the best move I've ever seen. I don't know if that's the best move that Sane has ever taken. Codebreaker and Senton combo by Green and Niven, and then Jade stops the Unprettier, slams Green in place as Piper is climbing the ropes and inadvertently hits her partner with a Vader bomb. That too can happen in the fog of war. And Jade then lifts Niven onto her shoulders for a doomsday device, Belair pinning Niven in 12 minutes. Match had its some awkward moments, but I have to say the crowd was really into this, and I did not have gigantic hopes for this match, and I thought this was overachieved for what I saw going into it, and this crowd really elevated this one as well. They built up to several big high spots, and I think overall, like the hiccups included, I thought this was entertaining for the 12 minutes they had.
I agree. I thought it was a very ambitious match. You know, there were a lot of spots required precision involving multiple women, and not all of it was perfect. But all in all, I found it to be a very consistently entertaining match that did a good job of keeping up this like very high level of pace while finding something to do for all eight women involved. I thought everybody was given pretty good focus. I love how much reverence they give Io and Bianca's amazing chemistry together. Like, they're almost promoting this as like one of the signature rivalries of at least this modern division, and they should. Their athletic chemistry together is like maybe the best among anybody in the women's division right now. But I got to talk about like Jakara Jackson and Lash Legend. It is crazy how much new experience that they've given these two in a very short amount of time. Like, to go from wrestling like 99% of their career in the PC about a month ago to now performing on the stages that they have in these like few weeks, I think it's pretty amazing. Like, Jakara Jackson, this is her second main roster match and only her 62nd match total in her entire career. So they're clearly like impressed enough with their abilities to handle these type of high pressure situations that they keep putting them into these sort of opportunities. And I think we could say that they've done well. I don't think they've been tasked to do quite a bit in ring on live television in front of big crowds. And there haven't really been any sort of like big notable screw ups. They look like they belong in the division, so I think these two have done really well. And I mean, again, like they already pretty much feel like they're called up at this point.
Yeah, Lash has made, you know, a lot of improvements. Like, she was one, and there's going to be a lot of these people in this. You know, when you're recruiting these athletes and they're on television so early, there's ones that, like, she was not ready for television. And when you have a national audience that is seeing you having your first matches and you're not clicking and you're not picking this up, that's a hole you have to kind of dig yourself out from. And I think Lash, this, you know, she is not the top of the food chain, but I think those improvements are very noteworthy, and they're coming at a time when more and more people are now seeing her.
And more importantly, I think charismatically, they feel like they kind of already have that, you know, that part lined up. So yeah. We'll see if they get an official call up sometime soon, but I expect it pretty quickly.
Seth Rollins and Bronson Reed followed. And this was, so last week at the Brooklyn taping, Seth had his first match since Money in the Bank doing a dark match with Dominic. But I would classify this as your first real match since coming back. So that's several months. He was also wearing like the loose fitting pants that you saw Shawn Michaels transition to later in his career. I'd be curious if he was, if he's working with a knee brace. He did not have these pants in that dark match last week. So I don't know if this is a permanent move to him, but that was his visual aesthetic here. And also noting, this is his 11th match in Saudi Arabia, as Graves notes to Seth being such a workhorse and the miles he's put on his body. 11 matches in Saudi Arabia, nearly two a year.
Has he missed one? Oh, wait, he's missed one then, I guess, if he's done 12 events.
Yes, he's missed one.
Okay.
So, can't be that strong a workhorse, right, if you missed one.
Has there been a wrestler that's appeared on every single show, I wonder?
No, I don't think so, because they probably would have noted it on the show. I can't think. Someone's going to correct us if we're wrong.
Okay.
Rollins attacks him on the ramp before the bell and then is caught, and Seth gets dumped into the timekeeper's area, landing horribly on this office chair, and his back looked like some animal attacked it. It just looked hell of an injury to have on your 10-hour flight home afterward that you'll be leaning against.
I hope he gets an upgrade to first class.
I hope so, too. I think all of them should be flying first class after this one. The bell finally rings, and Reed immediately hits a tsunami, but instead of going for the pin, he climbs for a second one, and Rollins gets out of the way and hits the curb stomp. So this was like a Brock Lesnar layout at the beginning of this, and he gets the two count. Then Seth teases a pedigree and gets stopped, and Rollins goes over top and gets hit with a seated splash. There's a powerbomb countered by a DDT by Rollins, and he starts to recover, and after kicking out of a spinning sit-out powerbomb, a DVD, and a superplex, Rollins is told, stay down. And Rollins yells, you should have finished me when you had the chance. Ha ha. And Reed drops him and sets up for the tsunami. Rollins rolls away, then rolls to the floor. And Reed gets stopped on the floor and curb stomped onto the steps, rolls in Reed for the super stomp, and Rollins wins in 12 minutes and 21 seconds, and immediately, and yeah, Bronson got totally busted up here above his left eye. I imagine this was on the stair spot. This looked brutal too.
It looked brutal, but it was so perfect for this particular moment. You know, like, here's the giant who has not only fallen, but Seth drew blood, and like, Reed standing up with his look like afterwards with that stream of blood flowing down his head was just the perfect sort of like anime like visual, you know.
Immediately, Michael Cole proclaims that Bronson Reed has proven he deserves to be in the main event. It's like, did he? Isn't that what he was fighting for in this match and he failed?
I think he was proving that he belonged on the same stage as a Seth Rollins.
So just having the match, he achieves this.
Yes.
It's like, what did the win mean then?
That he was capable. He belonged even more.
Oh, okay.
than just the Seth Rollins.
He's proven position. That he's a B show main eventer, not A show, but B show.
Let's not even get that far. This is not the main event. He proved that he belonged on a PLE. Is what,
like,
he proved.
There's a delicate way of handling someone losing and still putting them over. But as soon as that hand hit three and Cole is getting into this, it's like, we just watched Rollins prevail here. I don't know what Reed is. It felt jarring to me.
Okay. Well, again, like, I don't know what Cole should have said instead in this
Fuck
situation.
This guy. That's what he should have said, okay? WH Park, this push.
What do you think of the match overall?
Good. I don't think it got to great, but I did think this was the best match on the show thus far. I would put it slightly ahead of ahead of the tag match that we had just seen, but would not be match of the show for me.
I thought it was a good match, though, like a step down from, I think, the spectacles that Reed and Strowman have had. You know, you can tell that they were trying to recapture some of that magic here, but like with more of a big man, small man type of formula. The Reed Strowman matches, I think in hindsight, were just like really something special when you're seeing two guys just like throw each other at their size into various things. But I would say overall, they did a good job of keeping that intensity really high throughout. I think Rollins kind of needed that win in order to, what, get revenge for that big beatdown that started all of this. And
gets him into this number one contenders match that we'll get into that's happening on Monday.
True. Did you get the sense that this feud in some way was continuing, just kind of given this like exchange of looks between the two, or was this more just like Reed showing that you didn't kill me? You
know? If Rollins is not going for the title next, which I have a hard time imagining he would be, I could see them running this one back. That seems to be a lot of the formula, is that the guy gets the win, but the guy you're ultimately pushing then gets his win back. And
are you not aware that we have a best of 10, best of X, you know, series going on right
this
now?
This is just the beginning.
Yeah. Also, people mentioning the MF Doom attire from Bronson Reed. MF Doom died 4 years ago on October 31st, so I think that was probably the reason for that.
Yeah, this was Corey Graves actually noted that in the commentary, so he was on top of that one. Nia Jax and Liv Morgan, our first Crown Jewel Championship match, which, you know, the important facts, 3,273 embedded stones, 50 carats of diamonds, 250 total carat weight, and all emeralds are Australian crystals. So for all of these people that are upset about Indy Hartwell being cut, do know WWE does care about Australia.
Right, okay. Do you think that these are legitimate stats?
Like, would WWE lie about stats on its promotional material?
Well, I'm not sure. I
have no way of fact checking this, so I would have no idea. None of this means anything to me. I don't even know what embedded stones versus non-embedded stones would appear to be.
Embedded, I guess, just means that they're stuck on.
Yeah. Yeah, that these performers get to look at this thing and then leave it here in the country and go home with a ring that's probably made out of plastic.
I would say
all our funding went into these belts. Yeah. We don't have a budget for rings.
Embossed steel, maybe.
Yeah,
we do have looks at the rings if you're curious about that.
Oh, I would love to see them afterwards. Okay. They also recapped a Rhea Ripley's orbital bone injury that was legitimate, and they wrote her off on NXT this past Tuesday and showing the X-ray of that. So Ripley to miss. Probably a significant period of time, as this orbital bone injuries are awful. Terrible from those that I've heard from that have had to recover from these.
No, you know, it's never good timing to get injured. In her case, though, this might be good timing. Like, just hopefully gets her in before WrestleMania season, you know, like, and just kind of like it makes the audience miss her that much more before she can come back and reclaim the championship from Liv.
I would think Rumble would be your optimistic viewpoint that she could come back for. Mm-hmm. That's what, February 1st? So that would give you, you know, 3 months of recovery from an injury of this level. So Liv Morgan, tough match to structure here. It's like we have the double heels, Liv having to, you know, be the undersized heel in this, because it kind of defaulted to like Nia Jax being your closer, like, approximate babyface in this kind of a scenario. But
wait, you mean by the end, or because I thought the crowd was pro Morgan.
I'm just saying, in terms of like the actual match structure, it felt as though they were trying to make Nia more of the sympathetic one than Liv.
Interesting.
You didn't take it that way.
I kind of had the opposite read, just because of the
well, then it tells you how difficult this was to structure, of however you want to take this. Morgan goes after the knee of Nia. So she's selling the knee, and Liv manages a tornado DDT, but then Jax catches her with a Samoan drop. But then, you won't believe this, Nia Jax ran shoulder first into the post, which this has to be her Ric Flair getting caught on the top. There is not one match that goes by that Nia does not do this spot as the way for the babyface to get heat. She hits a Samoan drop off the second turnbuckle, but only gets a two count. So both women are down, and Tiffany Stratton comes down with the briefcase. And this crowd, all they cared about was seeing a cash in. Like, this was, they were not going crazy for this match, but they were for Tiffany Stratton, as she shows up and teases cashing in. When Nia gets up, she just like, she's a zombie that just awakens and tells Tiffany, "What are you doing?" And Stratton explains, "I was going to cash in on Liv." And Nia is just like, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" And Tiffany has explained this, but Nia tells her to leave. Wasn't this the whole setup to the story? Was that I'm going to destroy Liv, and then you can cash in on her?
It was that, but then on SmackDown, Stratton blatantly said, "I'm going to cash in on either one of you." So I don't exactly know like what Nia was so surprised by in all of this. Like I thought her reaction tonight was almost completely negligent of any of the storytelling that we saw prior to it.
They went with the assumption no one watched the taped edition of SmackDown last night.
Yeah, they did.
Mm-hmm. They were like, you know what? There's no rewind to SmackDown for these people to catch up on. Why even reference it in our story?
Of course.
So Liv turns a Samoan drop into a crucifix bomb, gets a two count, and Stratton, who has been sent up the ramp, pauses and then returns. So the whole crowd, they cheer as she returns, teases the cash in, but now Raquel Rodriguez shows up, going after Stratton's briefcase. Then Raquel snaps Jax on the rope into a code breaker for a big near fall. Dominic appears, and then Raquel and Liv confront Stratton and are attacked from behind by Jax, and then Nia hits the leg drop, calls for the Annihilator. When Dominic slides the briefcase in, the referee runs toward the briefcase to make sure the briefcase is okay. And this allows Raquel to knock Nia off the turnbuckle, setting up Oblivion as Liv wins in 8 minutes and 14 seconds of a match that I just was totally checked out from. I did not think the wrestling was very good in this. I didn't think the dynamic worked, and then they just overbooked the hell out of it, and that's all this crowd cared about, was seeing a cash in. And I just felt this was more like a means to an end to get out of this. I honestly thought this was the weakest match on the show.
I agree with that. I thought that, like, we were talking about the women's matches, I thought the tag match was far better than what this was. I thought this match was pretty messy. It was already a tough dynamic having these two heels face off with each other, but I think they were trying their best to navigate that with, like, the size differences. I wouldn't say even before the Tiffany Stratton cash-in that they got to a very high level in terms of, like, just...
Not at all.
Engagement. I and then by the time Tiffany got in, I thought all of that was so groan inducing and almost too blatant. You know, like with these cash-ins, to me, the excitement is like when somebody rushes in and there's just this urgency to like see if they can find their perfect opportunity. This one just kind of felt like it was like Stratton lingering, you know, and it just didn't really like have that sort of heightened level of like intensity at all. And Nia, I thought, looked really dumb for just allowing all of this to happen, even though, like, the entire build-up into this point was, like, Stratton warning, you know, Nia, that this was about to happen. And then just, like, a really messy rush towards what ultimately was a distraction finish. So, very unsatisfying pretty much on all those fronts. The booking, it surprised me, you know? Like, I guess I would have anticipated the Nia Jax winning it, but they let Morgan have it using Raquel and Dom as sort of, like, her X-factors to help her achieve the win. And I don't dislike it at all, especially coming off of the Rhea injury. This might be arguably a better use of the crown jewel gimmick to give to her, just to kind of supercharge her status. Whereas Nia winning, I mean, she's already just the big heel beating the smaller heel, and I don't know if it would have necessarily added so much to Nia's aura. But maybe for Liv, it does a bit more.
Yeah, because as we learned during the promo on SmackDown, Liv now holding 3 championships, with the crown jewel championship, the women's title, and Dominic.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is what the women are fighting over. Dominic is the overall championship that they are. Oh, is this the ring? Right. Look at this thing. That's pretty big. Ring. It's like
it's a big ring.
How many embedded diamonds do you see there?
You know, hard for me to tell in this blurry photo, but yeah. I anticipate a lot.
Yeah. Also coming out of this, like, it seems as though you would have Nia and Raquel having some issue coming out of this, and maybe we're just like, in the absence of Rhea, that you're just gonna forego the brand split, while, like, it's not like Nia has any opponents built up for her, and you did this finish that Nia should not just go back to SmackDown and have no follow-up to this.
Well, maybe Nick Aldis and Adam Pearce can work something out.
Maybe they'll reach a settlement over an angle that is going to be coming up at the end of this one. So Randy Orton and Kevin Owens is supposed to be next. Kevin Owens comes out in his Cowboy Bob Orton shirt as he's recovering from his dune buggy accident that they never, I believe, brought up on the show, but it was referenced by Owens in his promo on the pre-show. And Randy Orton took about an hour to make his entrance as the crowd is singing along to his song. And Owens ends up attacking him with a chair before the bell rings. They fight to the floor. He's dumped on the desk, and then Owens kicks at Orton's knee, continues to use the chair until referee Eddie Arango grabs the chair, leading to Owens stunning the ref. Orton takes the chair. He starts using it while limping, and Cole notes the match has been waved off. It will not happen tonight. Owens strikes down Jamie Noble, and then coming to rip the chair away in his return to Saudi Arabia after things went so well the first time, Sean Daivari, who left Greatest Royal Rumble getting death threats for, you know, a simple feel-good angle involving Saudi Arabian and Iranian tension, making his return here to the country, rips the chair away from Orton. He's thrown into the post. And then a draping DDT is executed to Owens when Pierce and Aldis enter. And the big spot is Randy hitting an RKO to Adam Pierce, and someone they protect extremely, as we were just talking about on Wednesday with, you know, your authority figures. It's very rare that they have Adam Pierce or Aldis they've done nothing physical with. And this is a rare instance with Pierce. So I imagine this was done for a significant purpose. And it was brought up the fact that the last time Randy Orton paid his fine, he paid it double for the next time as well. So he might be covered for this one.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Yes. And then they brawl into the crowd. They were not done yet. And the big spot was Owens leaping off a barricade, putting Orton through the table with an elbow drop. So you didn't get the match, but it's not like they didn't give you quite a bit here. And I guess extending this to, you know, follow up with this match at a future date.
Could be even Survivor Series, or maybe I don't know, big addition of SmackDown, for instance. Yeah, I mean, this is kind of part of their playbook, and people just don't seem upset if you don't give them the match result, as long as you give them like a big stunt that makes them feel like their time wasn't wasted. And I thought this
came off better than the Bloodline six man.
What, like the match itself?
What was involved here? I was like, I was fine with this. It's late in the show. Do an angle. I don't know. I can understand in the pay-per-view era that people, like, if this was a big advertised match that you feel ripped off from, I don't have that feeling in this current environment and extending it. And you gave people a big spot, and
there's really nothing at stake, like, in this match. I think it was just more of a heated feud that, you just kind of wanted to see two guys like fight each other for, and this appropriately escalated it, and you know, we'll see what level of fines both men get.
LA Knight, Carmelo Hayes, and Andrade. What is this considered? Is this game one or is this game eight?
Have they had three ways before? I forget.
They haven't done a three way, but LA Knight has beaten each of them individually, so now they both get title shots.
7.8, maybe. Game 7.
This is the most confusing series I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Michael Cole is referring to, he goes, "Hey, Cody," and Corey corrects him. He's like, "I'm Corey." And Cole's like, "Man, I've had a rough night with names. I called Jade Cargill Cora Jade on the pre-show." I mean, guy's just throwing out his mistakes all night. So the match begins. Knight is sent out of the ring as Andrade climbs and teases diving onto Hayes, but instead does an Orihara moonsault to LA Knight on the floor. This looks spectacular.
Awesome.
With the rotation he got. Hayes follows with a Topekan Hero. Crowd was very hot for this. And then they just came up with various three-way spots. Hayes blocked the Blunt Force Trauma with the handstand, sending Knight into a spinning elbow from Andrade. And then Hayes suplexes Andrade on top of Knight, going for the double pin. Andrade hits the Destroyer, which, I mean, we have pretty much got to the point, like, this has no country of origin anymore. Like, the Destroyer has just been taken away, you know?
Well, I mean, is a Boston Crab, does that have to be?
It's not the Crab. We don't have the German suplex, it's just the suplex.
Gotcha, you're saying
there's no more Canadian Destroyer, it's just a Destroyer.
It's true. I mean, there are a lot of syllables, maybe.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, it's not fair.
I feel slighted. I do feel slighted.
Yeah.
This is one of our few contributions. They line up Hayes and Knight as Knight comes off the top turnbuckle with his double elbow drop. He goes for a pinfall on each of the men, and there are kickouts. Andrade and Hayes then fight on top, and then LA Knight goes to leap to the top. Kurt Angle smoothness, this was not. He slips, same spot as I mentioned with Io Sky, but just repositions himself and completes the move. And then we just get into a sequence here as Hayes goes for nothing but net, Knight kicks out, and then the finish. Hayes goes for La Mystica onto Andrade, and in mid-rotation, the Blunt Force Trauma is hit to Hayes. Very well-executed finish, and Hayes eats the fall from LA Knight at 9 minutes and 8 seconds. I thought these two, all three of them, I thought this worked out really well overall. Like, I thought they had a lot of creative spots. I watched this and I could totally see Andrade and Hayes ending up as a tag team at some point, as we joked about, because I thought they worked really well in some tandem spots here. And I don't see much for them beyond this in terms of a singles capacity. And I think LA Knight, like, he's like, this guy is not the world's greatest in ring talent, but in a three way like this with Andrade and Hayes, I thought like he had his moments minus the slip. This was one much like the women's tag match where my expectations were not that big, but I would say like these two met them. I keep saying two.
Well, I don't know what that means, John, because I kind of think that, to me, that is sort of the point of that I'm trying to going to make, is that, yes, it was a really excellent match. I think Hayes and Andrade's chemistry continues to shine. They seem to be at their very best tonight, you know, in front of this large crowd. Knight, on the other hand, just kind of feels like he's playing catch up at times, you know, at least in the body of this match. But, you know, they did come up with a really nice out of nowhere BFT for him at the end. He is the star and the lone babyface in all of this. So that alone, I think, was enough to like give him like a significant role. But I kind of feel like in ring he got a little bit outclassed by the other two here.
Oh, he was the clear number three in this match. Like, there was no argument there. And that's like,
is
that's
that,
LA Knight.
That
like,
this guy's, is that how you want to present your baby face?
Listen, that's the story on LA Knight. Like, here's a guy that's like, he's very average in terms.
That's not
of,
what they're trying to promote. That's not how they're
but,
trying to push.
But this guy was clearly like the biggest star of these three, and he's the most over of these guys. Like, that's what you're riding here. And it's, let's be honest, this is a era where I think it's easier to have like how often do we get the this is awesome chance? Like, it's very basic matches that get amplified by some of these crowds that just are like, they will take average matches and make them feel that much more because they get really into matches. So, that I mean, I'm watching and sometimes like just I feel like I'm watching a different match sometimes. Like, it's just very basic stuff that the crowd reacts to, and I don't think there's that same level of expectation on like having going out and having to perform at the level of like the elite of the industry.
Well, there isn't, but at the same time, I can definitely say that I don't think these crowds gravitated towards LA Knight and all of this because he's average. There's something exceptional about his level of charisma or just like whatever he's able to present that others don't have. And I don't necessarily think that was showcased well in this feud with Hayes and Andrade. What did we see in the lead up to this? It was LA Knight putting on a referee shirt and just interrupting a really great match that these two other guys have. Like, what they're trying to present here is that Andrade and Hayes are great wrestlers and LA Knight is not. And he's so not a great wrestler that he's just there to like kind of ruin great wrestling. And I don't think that's the impression that you want to give tonight. At the same time, I don't think this feud has done a whole lot for Andrade and Hayes. Like, this result only reaffirms that they are mid-card guys underneath an LA Knight. So by the end of this, I guess I question how much anybody's ever like really gained from this particular feud. And it just kind of feels like it's a way to like get Hayes and Andrade a pay-per-view slot. It carries Knight through another season before he finally faces like the guy that he's going to drop his title to. But all in all, I don't know if this was the best use of all three of them.
Well, I enjoyed the match for what it was. I'm not the biggest proponent of LA Knight, but I think this guy has a great appeal, and I think that carries him significantly. I think that is
he needs the right opponent.
Certainly, like the matches are the least impressive part of his of what he has. I think that's a fair assessment.
Support for this Post Wrestling Podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from Post Wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MCU Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. Tag us in a photo of yourself wearing our merch on social media, and I'll even send you a signed postcard while supplies last. That's chop-tees.com/postwrestling.
They announced the post show coming up after the show, which would include the Crown Jewel Championship ceremony, which is we have not been following along with, but that was taking place on
no press conference.
They didn't promote any press conference. It was just this championship ceremony that they were going to be doing. And then Raw will have a number one contenders match with Seth Rollins, Damian Priest, Dominic, and Sheamus for the next contender to Gunther. And that is who is next, taking on Cody Rhodes in our final match of the evening for the Crown Jewel Championship. And so this felt very much like, if I'm curious Way's thoughts, because he has been critical of some of the Okada style building of a match. And that's what this match kind of felt like. It had its DNA in, like, very slow, methodical start. Cody is trying to wrestle with Gunther, but man, this audience, they could have just exchanged sleeper holds for 20 minutes. And I think this audience would have been losing its mind. Like, they were just into everything. Mm-hmm. And it gave you like this big match type of feel. And it was like, they knew they had this crowd from the second this bell rang. And it's just simple stuff. Like, Cody goes for a bionic elbow. It's stopped with this giant chop and everyone gasps. And Cody gets his back driven into the apron. So he's selling the back throughout most of the match. Then the crowd starts singing Ole, as Cole notes they're clearly trying to egg on Gunther by reminding him of his last loss, which was to Sami Zayn back in at WrestleMania in April. So then he starts working on the arm of Cody. Again, like, this is just a very slow build for what was going to be kind of the final stretch. The crowd starts chanting for Dusty after Cody finally hits the bionic elbow. And then Gunther avoids a disaster kick, applying the crab, the Massachusetts crab, and then goes into a sleeper. They are very aggressively trying to get this sleeper across as the most deadliest submission in the company. And then German's Cody, and we go back to the sleeper, and this is where Corey Graves compares it to when Nate Diaz submitted Conor McGregor, and Cody breaks free, hits the crossroads, both men are down, and then Gunther gets to his feet first, hits the powerbomb, and starts playing around with Cody, slapping him, mocking him, and Cody stands up, fires back at him, and hits another crossroads. Gunther kicks out and then tries for a third crossroads, which is stopped by the snapmare, and Cody scales to the top, thankfully in another corner, so there was no slip here, goes for the super Cody cutter, but is caught in the sleeper, so Cody rotates back, landing on top and catching Gunther for the three count, around 23 minutes, and Cody is your Crown Jewel champion, and Gunther goes up to Cody, shakes the man's hand while also appearing to give him a lecture. And they note that, like, he looked very aggressive with this handshake. And Cole notes that, you know, these are two great captains that we have on Raw and SmackDown. And then we have Levesque in with various Saudi officials and Liv Morgan too, as they all pose with their 5,000 pound championships. And we got about $5 million of pyro going off in the background as we complete the company's most lucrative day of the year, coupled only by the other day of the year that they run in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. And that's a fact.
Yeah. Nothing like a $50 million day. That's always a nice gross.
Yeah, and we're just talking about the show itself now. Like, with WrestleMania weekends, including, I guess, all the money they might make, like, in addition to the show itself, like, is that figured in? Does this still lap that?
This would still be ahead of your WrestleMania. Well, I state that without knowing where we're going to land for this Vegas show, okay. The Vegas shows next year, because they're going to do some incredible gate. I think if you combine the two, that should top 50, but don't quote me on that. Next year, there may be more close, but WrestleMania is not doing $50 million up until this point. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The match itself, so you asked me, okay, like, I'm critical of the Okada slow pace, you know, main event types of matches. Did I feel the same way about this one? I think for me, much of my discontent with many of those Okada matches is because I'm not that excited about the matchup, period. Like, he has that style of match with anybody in the main event. This, to me, I think they did a much better job of building to make you feel like it was special. You know, for all we can say about, like, these sort of champion versus champion gimmicks of the past, I think they did a great job this year around to make this feel like it was something significant that, despite maybe how we might feel about the, you know, this giant gaudy championship or the ring, they did still make this, like, the bragging rights, for lack of a better word, of this particular match feel significant. They created what felt like a really personal rivalry between the two through some excellent, you know, promo segments. And I think that accounts for a whole lot. And when you have the type of reaction that you got tonight, a slow pace is a good way to go. You know, like it lets the crowd take center stage and lets them provide the content of the match and the entertainment value of the match. And I thought they did that to a really strong degree. Up until the wave and up until maybe some of these other chants, there was even a point where I think, certainly if you ask me, even if you ask portions of this crowd, where I think they went too slow. And there were signs for them to ramp this up to, you know, a higher degree that they kind of started to do, but maybe, this match it got to the point where I would classify it as like being too slow. And by the time that they got to the finish, I thought they delivered some really, really strong near falls, but it was like a step short from, I think, the best Gunther matches we've seen. Was it at the level of like the best Cody matches we've seen? I would classify this as like a similar type of like match to like maybe the Reigns match at WrestleMania, without the run-ins, much cleaner. And listening to the soundtrack, like you can't argue with the results. You know, this was an incredible atmosphere that they created. And, I think the type of match and the type of reaction that this crowd wanted by the end.
Yeah. Like I would say by default, I felt like what was your match of the show?
Let me see. That's a good question. What was the match of the show? Because, okay, if there were faults, I would say maybe with a lot of the matches. The Bloodline match was not a great in-ring match. Reed versus Rollins was good, but maybe like not at such a great level.
I didn't think anything achieved great on this show. Like yeah. I would lean towards Cody and Gunther because I do feel like the audience did make this feel like a big match. They worked it like a competitive champion versus champion type of match. But I didn't feel this was anywhere near the level that it could be. The crowd enhanced it greatly, and maybe that's the ultimate barometer for most. But like I'm looking at this show, and it's just like I don't think any of these matches really jumped out in terms of, like the totality of this show was not a thumbs up show for me.
Well, I find it a really interesting question because like even though like I'm having such a hard time picking even like my favorite match on the show. Like what that is telling me is that like in ring content, this was a disappointing show. Like when you compare this to like any like average AEW offering, for instance, like an AEW pay-per-view completely destroys this in terms of in-ring. But was I dissatisfied with the show? No, not really. Like I kind of enjoyed it because of the atmosphere that was attached to a lot of these shows. I think like most of the matches gave you like good, like significant storyline like results or just like, you know, narrative, like I think advancement, you know, in the form of like Sami Zayn now being fully attached into this Bloodline story. You have, I guess, you know, like results in both of these Crown Jewel Championship matches. Big stunt with like, you know, Owens and Orton. So like I felt like I saw a satisfying pay-per-view, but in terms of in-ring content, definitely on the lower end of any modern WWE offering.
All right. I've got about 15 minutes, so let us do calls and feedback. If I have to jump out, Wei will complete the rest of the show.
Yeah, we invite all of our patrons to call in on these pay-per-view reviews. We also take calls every single Friday so on our Rewind a SmackDown shows exclusively in the Post Wrestling Cafe. If any of you guys want to jump in right now, you have the link in the show description. Apologize, YouTube members. I actually forgot to send the link to you, so I will do that right now. But we don't have any calls at this moment, so let's go to forum.postwrestling.com instead.
We're going to start off with Jeremy in Texas, who writes, I can't say I had Roman Reigns taking the pin on my Crown Jewel bingo card today. Does anyone play Crown Jewel bingo?
There's a drinking game somewhere, I'm sure.
I'm interested to see if getting pinned by Solo humbles the Roman Reigns character moving forward. With Sammy showing up at the end, it's fairly obvious where we're heading for Survivor Series. The journey should be fun. The Women's Crown Jewel match seemed clunky, having two heels in it did not help. Some may be disappointed to see Gunther lose the Men's Crown Jewel title match, but the rare Gunther loss further establishes his arrogance as his flaw. The broadcast really pushed Gunther, wanting to make Cody pass out from the sleeper. The sudden pin also doesn't really hurt Gunther, in my opinion. Who is footing the bill for these rings if they are actually what they say they are? Certainly doesn't seem like cost synergy. these Saudi Arabia shows are what they are. It was fine. But these shows always seem to feel like they are missing something.
Who's footing the bill for these rings? I mean, I think it barely puts a dent in the amount of money that they're actually making for these shows. So it might be in the budget. I would also contend that maybe these aren't legitimately what they say that these things are.
No way. Come on.
Why? Like, what? There's no point in creating that sort of liability, right? Like, why would you want? Like, think of the insurance headache that like Liv Morgan and Cody Rhodes would have to go through just to kind of own these things.
Yeah, what if they end up in a pawn shop in Buffalo?
Oh, that'd be awful. All right, let's go to one more piece of feedback before we go to our call. Let's go to Annie, who says, I thought this was a decent show. I can't say the first four matches particularly took me, but I didn't think they were awful either. The Kevin Owens-Randy Orton angle was good for what it was, but I hope Owens eventually gets a win over Orton. The US three-way was very good. The main event, however, was outstanding and a nice chapter between these two, which left me wanting more. In my opinion, it further cements Cody as the clear frontrunner for Flair Thez this year, when you couple his success at the box office with excellent performances in the ring and on the mic, which direction are you guys leaning at the moment for the Flair Thez?
For Wrestler of the Year, Cody has a very strong argument. Very strong.
Who's in contention this year, really?
I mean, it's
Cody.
I mean, I still feel like you are going to have votes for Ospreay. I think for sure he'll win most outstanding, but
he's not company champion. You can argue he's not leading.
Yeah, like that's going to be the argument against him.
It's
a combination of both. Like Cody should be the front runner this year. I think he is the strongest candidate, but it's an interesting year. Like, how many years have you seen of someone like a Will Ospreay that will get support from people when you're looking at all of it? Yeah.
All right, let's go to our one phone call here, and this comes to us from Hanzi. Hey, Hanzi, welcome to the show.
What's going on? I just finished it because I didn't get to watch it live. I'm never really looking for, like, again, some of the angles got me invested a little bit, but I never really look forward to these shows, really. You know what I mean? So it's never really like mandatory watching for me when it comes to the day of. But I thought, yeah, I have the same sentiment as you guys in the sense that I didn't think anything was like super great. I think the women's tag team match exceeded my expectations. I actually think there's better, like, recently, because, again, the tag team division in WWE has always kind of been cursed. It feels like there's a little bit more direction, more so than the actual main women's title programs. You know what I mean? I'm not really, like, hyped up for, like, the storylines involving the women's champion with Liv and Nia. Like, and I don't really see – I know Tiffany's getting cheered, but I don't really see her as that baby face. I actually think it – I wish Chelsea Green would be in that position more so than Tiffany. I think more people would be behind Chelsea. I just think Chelsea has been really, really, really good the last, especially the last couple of weeks. Like, her and Niven running in on NXT, that was like the most aggressive stuff that Chelsea was doing. And I wish you saw more of that on the main roster. But I think Chelsea is like the person that I believe should be pushed, if that makes sense.
No, I totally agree with that. Let's go take us back to Money in the Bank in Toronto and Chelsea Green winning the briefcase that night. And putting her into this role with Nia Jax as just sort of like this sort of servant who legitimately would be scared of Nia, while at the same time like being entertaining enough that she would gain the crowd's appeal. I think that would be a much more successful formula for this type of character that they have for Stratton. But you know, Stratton had a lot of momentum heading into Money in the Bank. You know, like, she had an incredible first half of this year that I can say that they haven't really capitalized on. You know, I've not been digging this thing that she's been building with Nia, and I think she has a lot of ways to go before she could be billed as a successful babyface champion or would be successor to Nia Jax. But you know, let's see if they can get there.
And yeah, and before I go, I just say that I like the Cody and Gunther match. It just, I think Gunther needed it more, but I listen, it's a title that's not really going to mean anything anyways, but I would prefer Gunther just keep the momentum going, because I think his title, like, his stature need to be uplifted more than Cody, because Cody already beat Roman Reigns, right? So that's just it. And with the Sami Zayn and Corey Graves thing, I saw a lot of complaints about that. I guess it was more subtle on Raw, but I even picked up, because again, this I'll summarize it real quickly. Like, there is like a contingent of people that think the Palestine issue is like a one single issue that needs to be determined. And on Monday, Sammy said to Jay, he goes, you don't need to pick a side. You can just walk away. I thought that was more of a political statement, that considering what Sammy represents and all that, I thought that was like more like a political. I thought it was in my head, but now with Corey bringing that up, I just thought, it doesn't surprise me, because I believe that eventually, with the way things are going, that with politics, and it's going to be injected into every form of entertainment, especially when you have a lot of companies aligning with Saudi Arabia government and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not surprised that they're injecting this kind of stuff in there. Even if people want to think that it was ad lib by Corey, I think whenever they put something on air like that, I think it's always determined to now get more discourse going with the entertainment dollar. It's just my personal opinion, but I'll leave you guys with that, man. But thanks for recapping the show, man. I was listening while watching, man. You guys did a good job, and I appreciate the shows this past week, man. Peace out.
Thank you, Hansi. I think there was definitely discourse about that. I don't know how prevalent that you would want to assign like WWE that is necessarily courting this attention. I certainly did not read that into the line from Raw. That seemed to be a much more, innocent line that he was using with Jey Uso. Certainly my brain did not go in that direction. That was one of like the observations many people had of Corey Graves, and how you interpret it. You can listen to the context for yourself and decide how you want to take that comment. But there you have it. We are at the end of the road here. So thanks to everyone for joining us on this special Saturday show. Coming up tonight, Collision will be taking place from Philadelphia and going live right after at postwrestlingcafe.com. Our Kate from Montreal and John Cena, they will present Collision Course. We also have a brand new edition of Post Pro Res up earlier today with Karen Peterson and WH Park, going over multiple retirements coming up in the next year, as well as recent show results, a look ahead to Power Struggle that is happening on Monday. So you can go catch up on all your Japanese wrestling from Karen and WH. And then Sunday, we've got the end of Agatha All Along.
That's right. Yeah. A special season finale edition of MCU Later, joining Rich and WH for a special double episode review, will be Nate Milton, who is about to do double duty this week.
That's right. We have got him for the back-to-back appearances on MCU Later, and joining me Monday night as Waiting will be off on assignment. So Nate will join me as we will be going through Raw from Saudi Arabia. So look forward to that on Monday. And a quick glance, we have released our schedule for November up on the Post Wrestling Cafe. Some of the highlights this month, we will have coverage of both Power Struggle and New Japan and Stardom's historic crossover 2 event, plus two editions of Rewind Away. We are going to review what can only be described as just an atrocity to filmmaking, Death Warrior, featuring the likes of Quentin Rampage Jackson, George St. Pierre, Rashad Evans, Mauro Ranallo, and Keith, the Dean of Mean Jardine. And we are making Brandon sit in on this review for us, as he has made this choice. We will probably hold this against him by the end of it. And then at the end of the month, TNA Turning Point 2009, a very apropos title, as this was their last pay-per-view before the addition of Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff, as the company went through its turning point at the end of 2009.
Also the last time Styles and Joe and Christopher Daniels had a three-way.
Yes, a rematch of one of, if not the most famous match in TNA's history, happening 4 years after the original at Unbreakable. So that is headlining the show, plus Kurt Angle against Desmond Nigel Wolf on that show. Okay. So there you have it. PostWrestlingCafe.com. $6 gets you all of these extra shows, plus other perks like ad-free editions of Rewind to Raw and Rewind to Dynamite, updates sent directly to you, and much more. So PostWrestlingCafe.com to support Post Wrestling. That is it for us. Tune into Collision Course tonight, and we will speak with you later this week.